the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is humbled by the support of great listeners all over the world, like Andrew Rush, Mary Gruber, Jeffrey Adair, and Cameron Troxell. Thank you for voluntarily subscribing to this program. If you're able and you'd like to help, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. Those voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. And we have a new sponsor, Cinema Classics, a movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Just click on the link at peterbcollins.com. And hey, we'll pay for the shipping. Just enter PBC in the comments section, and your shipping will be free. Today, Andy Worthington returns to our program. He is the journalist who has exhaustively covered the American Gulag. He's the author of the Guantanamo Files, and he also is the lead commentator and co-producer of the film called Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And today we're going to talk, among other things, about the recent court decision regarding extraordinary rendition. Yes, extraordinary rendition was used first by Bill Clinton and then expanded exponentially by the Bush administration, where they used Gulfstream jets and Boeing airliners to transit individuals who essentially were kidnapped. And they were delivered to destinations like Guantanamo Bay, but many locations around the world where it was known that they would be tortured. And this is an ugly blight on America's recent history. And, of course, it ties in with Obama's failure to close Guantanamo, as he promised on day two of his administration. Andy Worthington, with a hot cup of tea, joins us from London. Andy, how are you tonight?
Yeah, I'm all right, Peter. How are you?
Always good to talk with you, and I like to check in with you frequently because you do provide almost daily coverage of the issues related to Guantanamo. And while the case of Omar Khadr has recently gotten some coverage in the American media, the rest of the story is pretty much off the radar of the U.S. corporate media. There was coverage as well, briefly, of the decision that we're about to discuss. And it pains me that this came out of allegedly what is the most liberal appeals court in the United States, located here in San Francisco, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Although that liberalism has been addressed by repeated appointments of conservatives, including Jay Bybee, the author of Bush-era torture memos, who has a lifetime appointment to that court. And Andy, why don't you start off just with a quick summary of the decision and the plaintiffs in the case, and then we'll talk a little bit about the background and this bizarre notion that we can declare secret things that have been out in the open for quite a while.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a case that was first brought by the ACLU in the Bush administration, you know, as an attempt to call for accountability for the extraordinary rendition and torture of foreign nationals. And the men who are involved are, in various ways, I think, some of them are known better than others, but they're an interesting cross-section, if you like, of the many, many dozens of people who were subjected to the CIA program under Bush. Probably the most well-known is Binyam Mohammed, the British resident who was seized in Pakistan shortly after the alleged high-value detainee Abu Zubaydah, and was tied into a fictional plot to detonate a dirty bomb in New York City, which seems to have come from the torture of Abu Zubaydah. But he was rendered to Morocco, where he says he was tortured for 18 months, then to a particularly horrible CIA dungeon outside Kabul in Afghanistan, known as the Dark Prison, and eventually to Guantanamo. And he was finally released in the UK last year. Another man is one of two Egyptian asylum seekers, who Ahmed Agiza, who was he was rendered with the help of the Swedish to Egypt in a very early rendition mission in December 2001, actually, and a particular blot on the Swedish reputation, I think, that they were involved in that. And these two men were taken to Egypt and were both tortured there. There's a man called Abu El Qasim Britel, who was seized in Pakistan and rendered to Morocco. He's had a terrible time there, where he was rendered to Morocco, was freed by the Moroccans, and then recaptured by the Moroccans and subjected to some trumped-up charges in a trial, and is now serving a prison sentence there. There's another man, Mohammed Farag Ahmed Bashmila, a Yemeni, and he and two other Yemenis were picked up in various places in the world and ferried around a whole bunch of secret prisons before they were eventually taken back to Yemen, where the Bush administration asked the Yemeni government to keep them in custody and keep an eye on them. Although clearly they'd only been returned to Yemen because, you know, there had been obviously no reason for them being seized and subjected to all this in the first place. And the other man is Bishr Arawi, and he and another British resident, he's originally from Iraq, they were seized in the Gambia in December 2002, and they traveled there with Bishr's brother to invest in a mobile peanut processing plant. I think, from what I understand, they'd taken out £250,000 with them to invest in this, which mysteriously disappeared, never to return. There had been exchanges between the British and American intelligence services about these men, and they had, Bishr certainly, had been working for British intelligence. So they had, for some reason, turned on him, had decided that they would tell the Americans about him and Jamil and these other men in the Gambia, and both of these men ended up being sent to the dark prison in Afghanistan and then on to Guantanamo. And Bishr's brother was a British citizen. He had a passport. So he ended up coming back to Britain after just a few days in the Gambia. But Bishr and Jamil were subjected to this extraordinary, long detour around justice that took them first to Afghanistan and then Guantanamo. So, all these men very clearly have a very strong case that somebody did this to them, and is anybody going to be answerable to it? And this, you know, of course, is what the case has been about.
And as we've seen time after time, courts all over the United States, federal courts, have denied access to people with clear issues, with clear claims of their rights being violated by the United States government. And this really is just the latest sad story in that sequence. But once again, we have the situation where courts are finding for the government in a claim of the murky state secret privilege about information that is widely available on the public record. And
yeah,
that's what makes this so bizarre. Because I'm holding in my hands, Andy, the book called Torture Taxi. And this was published, in 2005 or 2006. But two Bay Area writers, Trevor Paglen and A.C. Thompson, really blew the lid off a lot of this using amateur plane spotters, who are the kind of geeky people who sit at airports and note the tail numbers of planes that come in and out. And this book details quite a bit, including references to Jeppesen Data Plan, which is the company at issue in the case that the court denied in its recent review of the appeal. And it also details that there's an airport in Fayetteville, North Carolina, a strip that has been used by various Gulfstream jets and other aircraft that were used to ferry these kidnapped victims around the world to deliver them to the torture sites that we have now been able to identify. And if people are at all interested, I really recommend this book because, again, it's all from open sources. And this is what makes the court ruling here so bizarre because, Andy, as you point out in a great article that I will link to in the show file for this episode, these are issues that were affirmed by a three-judge panel of the very same appeals court.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, this traditionally liberal court is clearly, on this issue, swung by 6-5 against it, because the three judges who said that the state secrets privilege was not appropriate when this was ruled on last May were joined by two other judges for this, and they reiterated their position. But, you know, when the court met en banc, and funnily enough, Jay Bybee was not included.
Indeed.
But when they met en banc, you know, suddenly there are six guys up against them who are just taking the government line, which is essentially how can we manipulate this little-known privilege that hasn't been used very much and nobody actually knows very much about to put up a barrier between the plaintiffs here who clearly have a case and the government, because politically we don't want this opened up to scrutiny.
And they amended the record to show that the claims of the plaintiffs are all just allegations now.
Yes. Yeah, they stuck allegedly into everything they could, didn't they? I mean, and the fact is that I suppose if we were to look at this in terms of a court case, then, you know, then that's perhaps appropriate. But not allowing it to proceed is a different matter.
Well, and let me interject, because I'm not a lawyer, but as I understand it, the function of an appeals court is not to find facts or to either alter the record or make a new record. They work on the basis of the district court's fact-finding and the information testimony that was presented in the lower court.
Yeah.
And the role of an appeals court is really to deal with technical legal issues, not the evidence before the courts.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think what's worrying is that it isn't just what's happened in this court, because this has started happening in the D.C. Circuit Court as well. Now, you know, those of us interested in progressive issues wouldn't expect very much from the notoriously conservative D.C. Circuit Court. But the same thing has been happening with appeals against the Guantanamo habeas decisions, is that I think the appeals court is overstepping its mark, not by reviewing it on a legal basis, but by chucking in its own opinions, effectively criticizing the decisions that are made by the district court on the wrong basis, on a political basis, effectively, is what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that essentially, you know, turns the law on its ear is that they are basically taking the word of one branch of government, the executive branch, first the assertions by Bush lawyers, and now the expanded assertions by Obama's lawyers, as basically trumping any rights that these individuals have. And as you point out, as Scott Horton has pointed out, and he's been a terrific journalist and analyzer of these issues, most of the information that the plaintiffs want to be heard on is on the public record.
Yeah.
And so we have, again, this bizarre sequence where the courts are covering up known facts and basically claiming, well, those are secret, even though they're right out on the table.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. You know, and I mean, what about the particular quote from the former Jefferson employee who, you know, who really, I think, opened up the whole thing in the first place by saying, you know, I'm told by the boss of Jefferson we're running these rendition flights. We're running the torture flights.
Yeah.
You know, that was the basis for Jane Mayer's article, The CIA's Travel Agent, back in 2006, I think it was, that kind of got the whole ball rolling. You know, everybody's shut out of this. You know, and that's simply unacceptable, of course.
Well, and let me lift a quote here that you include in your article. If the simple fact that information is classified were enough to bring evidence containing that evidence within the scope of the state secret privilege, then the entire state secrets inquiry, from determining which matters are secret to which disclosures pose a threat to national security, would fall exclusively to the executive branch, in plain contravention of the Supreme Court's admonition that judicial control over the evidence in a case cannot be abdicated to the caprice of executive officers without leading to intolerable abuses. And so, Andy, what we have here, pardon me, is the courts acting in concert with the executive branch to cover up issues that are already known, and it is a direct violation, I believe, of my constitutional rights, essentially to due process and the truth, even though I'm not a plaintiff in this case, and to a balance of power between these branches. And so we have activist judges who are activist on behalf of the executive branch's abuse of power.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what's been happening, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's interesting to speculate on quite, you know, who's pulling what strings and why, I think. I mean, I know why the Obama administration wouldn't want to open this up. I've always known why they didn't want to open up the most enormous can of worms to let anybody see that there might be accountability for the crimes committed by the previous administration. You know, it would be the biggest story ever. It would be the end of any kind of business as usual. Who knows what would happen? But everything has been to prevent that happening. And that's clearly how it's going to carry on. And I think, you know, what the reflection that I have on that as to where that puts the Obama administration is that there are so many pressure points within the administration, you know, of people saying, don't open that door. Just don't open that door. And I don't see how this can really be sustained forever. I mean, I think I've understood for quite a while that these kind of big and horrible stories are not the kind of things that get sorted out in a couple of years. You know, we may actually be looking at decades for people to be able to address them. But, you know, I think that really simply is the case with this. You know, the crimes that were committed by the Bush administration were so immense that nobody can contemplate seeking accountability for them.
Well, and Andy, as you and I have discussed before, the argument that Obama has made, and consider that he's a lawyer, he taught constitutional law, and he is claiming basically selective prosecution, that he can pick and choose which crimes will be investigated and prosecuted and which ones won't. And with his sweeping phrase of looking forward, not backward, he has bought a little time. But if the elections, and it's hard to predict exactly how this will turn out in November, things are very much in flux.
Yeah.
But if for example, the House of Representatives goes to Republican control, there will be a series of investigations. But they won't be about Guantanamo, they won't be about rendition, they won't be about important constitutional principles. They'll be about where Obama was born and whether or not he offered a senator an inducement to not to challenge a sitting senator in the election cycle this year. And, you know, maybe they'll find a White House official who's been sleeping around or, you know, they're going to go for very trivial investigations, but they will tie the Obama administration in knots. And the failure to pursue reasonable and obvious investigations and prosecutions during the first 2 years of this administration, they're going to pay an incredible price for that, if only politically. And, you know, that's putting aside the moral and long-term constitutional principles.
Well, absolutely, you know. What I meant by trying to understand where the pressure is coming from is that I think with so many of the decisions that have been made, the gulf between what we speculate that, with the best possible spin, President Obama may have thought about doing, just doesn't seem to have had the opportunity to arise in the first place. He's up against two particular organizations, I think, the military and the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be challenged. and I think they have a lot of pressure that they can exert. And, you know, that's my kind of cumulative feeling about the way these things have been going, is that how much is he actually in charge of?
Well, you make a good point, and, of course, that leads to various cans of worms about, okay, when was the last president who was truly independent of our intelligence community and not controlled by them?
Mm.
And we're hard-pressed, really, to find a point going back to the formation of the intelligence agencies during the Cold War in the 50s. Now, Eisenhower warned about the expansion of the military-industrial complex. He didn't speak as explicitly about intelligence. But, you know, starting with Kennedy, you can see that American presidents were, in various ways, struggling to control the intelligence community and to assert what they thought they had been elected to do as our quote-unquote commander-in-chief.
Yeah. Well, you know, but I mean, I also think there was probably a certain point in the 70s, you know, after Nixon, you know, certain serious reviews of behavior, which were fairly short-lived, you know, because then, you know, we get Ronald Reagan starting a new era of, you know, militant Americanism in,
right,
in some way. But, I mean, I actually think that the end of the Bush administration should have been equivalent to kind of after Watergate in a way, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's I think, however pragmatic it may have been for President Obama to behave as he did, it seems to me that history will say this was not what was required, actually.
Yeah.
What was required was something much more bold. But, you know, It's easy, I suppose, to overlook the fact that it would be hard to imagine a president inheriting more of a mess on all fronts than was inherited by President Obama.
Well, I certainly have that empathy, but at the same time, the way to sort through a mess is to organize around principles, organize around constitutional principles. And while I wouldn't expect it to happen overnight, I also am shocked, I have to say, to see that they've gone so far in the other direction.
Sure.
And so, personally, you know, I think Obama fumbled by declaring on day two that he would close Guantanamo, that he didn't understand the politics of that, even members of his own party. At the same time, once he made that commitment, even if it didn't occur on schedule, he's basically dropped it. He has acknowledged that he was defeated on that, and he's no longer pursuing it.
Well, he didn't act quickly enough on all kinds of things. You know, and as time has gone on, we've ended up with disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. You know, and that you know, very much clouds any opportunity that I might have to give him any benefit of the doubt, because it has been a catalogue of weaknesses and a lack of courage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an administration that now refuses to release people who have won their habeas corpus petitions, routinely refuses to accept any judgment that comes from the district court. You know, we had one exception in the last few months of a Yemeni student who was so patently innocent that even the mainstream media got involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this blanket ban on releasing any Yemenis, you know, and there are 58 Yemenis, I think, in Guantanamo at the moment, a quarter of the prison's population, who the task force that Obama set up said should be repatriated to Yemen at some point. But because the underpants bomber had apparently been trained in Yemen and the hysteria was cranked up to an intolerable degree in New Year, he imposed a blanket ban, and he hasn't said when, if ever, that will be lifted. And none of these men are going home. Does this just go on forever?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the examples of cowardice, they're just there over and over again. And they were present in the first few months in some ways, obviously in those bold statements in the executive orders. But, you know, in the decision to release those the torture memos in April 2009 in response to a court case. That wouldn't have happened after that. He would, after that, have found a way to suppress them because it got him a lot of flack. You know, and as a result of him getting a lot of flack, he never released those photos of detainee abuse that were required in the court suit, and he never followed through on White House counsel Greg Craig's plan to bring a couple of the Uyghurs, the Chinese prisoners in Guantanamo, to live in the United States, you know, which would have been a way of, the most profound way of demonstrating to the American people that mistakes have been made at Guantanamo. Bring a couple of clearly non-terrorist people, and once the right-wing hysteria has died down, people would have realized these are ordinary people. They were caught by mistake because something terrible had happened.
Oh, but Andy, they're Muslims. And this is one of the things that we really have to contend with, is the waves of orchestrated, pardon me, I'm working through a cough today, orchestrated Islamophobia. And we know that when Eric Holder said he wanted to hold the trials for KSM and the other alleged 9/11-related defendants in New York City, that there was this wave that was generated to block it.
Yeah.
And most recently, and I've detected this pattern now after 2 years, the Obama team doesn't recognize that in August, Republicans go wild. And last year was death panels and kill the health care bill.
Oh, yes,
and this year, it was all about this phony controversy over the proposed Cordoba Center in the Burlington Coat Factory down the street from the strip club and the off-track betting parlor on the so-called hallowed grounds near Ground Zero. And this has been permitted to occur because Obama is somewhat neutralized by his middle name and by this widespread myth that he's a Muslim. And that, of course, is promoted by the right wing and Fox News, and it really has started to stick.
No, absolutely.
And now they're building on it, and this leads to another point that's raised in your article, Andy. This week, Newt Gingrich has started a meme that we will not permit the United States to be ruled by Sharia law. Now, there is not even the remotest threat of that in any way, shape, or form. The flimsy basis he uses for this is that a couple of justices recently appointed and confirmed to the Supreme Court have acknowledged that they would look at international courts, at courts in other countries, at rulings from courts in other countries, as they consider how certain issues may be changing over time, and that that might have some influence in their judgments. But, you know, Newt Gingrich takes that to an incredible extreme and says that by considering the opinions of foreign courts, that this is an opening to Sharia law being imposed in the United States. And you quote Scott Horton talking about the British Court of Appeal that has reviewed the so-called formidable evidence in Binyam Mohammed's case. And so we now have a situation where the U.S. puts a blinder on at the American border and says, we have secrets that are contained here in the United States. They're widely available in England and broadly known around the world, but we are going to pretend that this information has been successfully suppressed.
Yeah. I mean, an interesting footnote to that is that the reason that the 18 months of stonewalling by the British Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, in Binyam Mohammed's case regarding the formidable evidence, the reason that that deadlock was broken was because a district court judge in the United States had exposed the torture of Binyam Mohammed in the habeas corpus petition of another man. And the government was attempting to claim that this the evidence against this man, which was produced by Binyam Mohammed, was reliable. And in that judgment, the judge, spent, you know, something like 30 pages of her opinion discussing what happened to Binyam Mohammed and why, as a result, his evidence was unreliable. And that then bounced back across the Atlantic and was used by the British court.
Well, then you better be careful, because that means that the British courts may be embracing Sharia law sometime soon. And just as Newt Gingrich is ready to protect you. We're laughing.
We have to laugh, Peter, don't we? I mean, the stirring up of Islamophobia is genuinely worrying. I mean, it always is.
Yeah.
You know, it's of a scale that I do find particularly distressing at the moment.
And it's
but
working.
I have to say that, you know, I think that's another reason why bringing the Uyghurs to the United States would have been such an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because these guys are from China. And you know, the odd thing about the Uyghurs is that although they're Muslims, because they're oppressed by the Chinese Communist government, they've actually always had the support of certain right-wingers, the ones who remember that, you know, before China owned the U.S. economy, you know, communism is our enemy. So there are, you know, Republicans who were prepared to side with the Uyghurs on the basis that they were people oppressed by the communists. But it never happened, you know. And these men are great for dismissing those kind of fears. You know, they don't fit into any boxes very easily. But, you know, I think I've said to you before, Peter, I do regard it as almost the single biggest failure, that you didn't just go ahead, put up with the criticism, because it would have died down. You know, every other country has had former Guantanamo prisoners accepted into them, and people have realized, hey, you know, if this is what a terrorist looks like, doesn't seem to be a terrorist to me. That would have punctured the myth so well.
Well, and what they're not clarifying and really, you know, forcing people to focus on is these people are being released for a simple reason. They're innocent.
Mm.
And so they're not terrorists, but the label has stuck because Dick Cheney said that if you went to Guantanamo, you're the worst of the worst. And so it's a very broad form of guilt by association, but it's been extremely effective. And this is something that Obama is unwilling to confront.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, and it keeps happening. I mean, you know, we're not actually seeing that many people released from the prison. It's another sign of, you know, the inertia in the administration. But, you know, two guys were released to Germany last week. Why is Germany taking these dangerous terrorists? Well, Germany absolutely concluded that they weren't dangerous terrorists,
right.
and they weren't.
And it didn't make the news here.
No, and I mean, what's interesting about it, actually, which I don't think has really turned up in the U.S. media at all, is that the German government demanded a written agreement with the Obama administration before taking these men to confirm that they were no threat, which apparently also includes an agreement that... you know, theoretically, they ought to be able to be free to travel, and the countries that they ought to theoretically be able to travel to would include the United States.
Now, Andy, I haven't heard anything about that agreement. Is that because it's a secret in the United States but not in Germany?
Yeah, I think the only country that's reported it is in Germany, and the only reason that I know about it is because Der Spiegel prints and a few other places in Germany also printed English.
Huh. Wow. That's amazing. And you know, over here, we just have these little firestorms that dominate our news coverage and things like that that, you know, I think are very valuable bits of information that people should know. And here we have a bilateral agreement regarding the release of these individuals from our custody. And it's simply not covered in the United States. And I'm glad to be able to talk to you and that you can share this information from your perspective, because otherwise I don't think it would be available here at all.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, in a way, Peter, that's what I've been doing all these years, isn't it? Is you know, writing. I mean, I always write about the prisoners who are released. I always write about what's known of their stories. And I do what I've become, I think, quite skilled at, which is to dissect the allegations that have been bandied around over the years and to analyze them and to ascertain what may have some truth in it and what is clearly fictitious, and the circumstances in which statements are unreliable because they're contradictory or they clearly have been derived through the questionable interrogation of other people, all these kind of things. I mean, it's been happening for years.
Mm-hmm.
It's available there, information about, hey, look, another guy who wasn't the worst of the worst was released. And since Obama came in, mostly these people have been released to America's allies, which are doing the very kind job of doing what America isn't doing. And I can see why that's not reported in the States, because, you know, it could possibly create some progressive movement to call for some responsibility within the United States for taking these prisoners, and which would oppose decisions that have been taken by the Obama administration, by Congress, and by the judiciary. I mean, everybody's in on this. Under no circumstances are prisoners who have been cleared by anybody, they don't care, by the Bush administration, by the U.S. courts, by Obama's task force, under no circumstances is a single cleared prisoner from Guantanamo ever going to come and live in the United States.
Well,
so Albania, Belgium, Bulgaria, France, Hungary, Ireland, Portugal, Slovakia, Spain, Switzerland, Bermuda, Cape Verde, Georgia, Latvia, and Palau have all done what the United States won't do with people who were captured by the United States.
And to underscore your point, we have cowards in Congress. The people who challenged Bush on these issues have all gone silent. Even the firebrand progressives, I don't hear Barbara Lee. I mean, Russ Feingold's up for re-election. He's not touching these issues.
No.
And so there is a conspiracy of silence to really just try to hush this up, sweep it under the rug. And what really is sinister about this, in my view, Andy, well, at least one aspect of sinister, is that, again, these are not secrets in other parts of the world. And it's also not a secret that Guantanamo remains a major irritant in the Muslim world. It's a major recruiting tool for the next generation of jihadists. And while we are complacent and think that, oh, it's behind us, we don't have to think about it anymore, it remains a flashpoint that at any time could erupt in what would be very surprising to most Americans if it resulted in some sort of an attack or other type of assault, even if it were computer hacking or some other kind of a non-lethal way of trying to even the score with the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so. I mean, you know, I tend to think that the threats against the United States are generally being staged by people who are in other parts of the world where the United States has a military presence in the Muslim world. I don't think there's any evidence of any internal threat in the United States. I would say what most sensible Americans realize is that there's an integrational aspect to Americanism. Which is probably functioning better in the United States than it does in Europe, in not alienating Muslims. You know, the aspect of being American and becoming part of America is a big thing for everybody who's American, whether they're a Muslim or not. It's one of the bonds that you have in a country that, in other ways, doesn't have any bonds at all. But yeah, I mean, I don't really see the threat. I can't even bear to think what would happen if there were to be something.
Yeah.
Because we've seen this hysteria all year, really. That we have not moved on in any significant manner from the early days after 9/11, when any time a terrorist suspect is captured, people are refusing to acknowledge that's a criminal activity, that they are a criminal suspect, that the police and FBI interrogators are perfectly capable of getting information out of these people without having to torture them.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself regularly quite appalled as to how much the macho torture myth has permeated American society, really.
Andy, I want to take one more bite at the Ninth Circuit's decision, and you quote a few passages from the dissenters. And this is a little thick in legalese, but I think it's worth quoting. It is true that, this is the dissenting judges, judicial construct though it is, the state secret doctrine has become embedded in our controlling decisional law. Government claims of state secrets, therefore, must be entertained by the judiciary. But The doctrine is so dangerous as a means of hiding governmental misbehavior under the guise of national security, and so violative of common rights to due process, that courts should confine its application to the narrowest circumstances that still protect the government's essential secrets, when, as here, the doctrine is successfully invoked at the threshold of litigation, the claims of secret are necessarily broad and hypothetical. The result is a maximum interference with the due processes of the courts on the most general claims of state secret privilege. It is far better to require the government to make its claims of state secrets with regard to specific items of evidence or groups of such items as their use is sought in the lawsuit. An official certification that evidence is truly a state secret will be more focused if the head of a department must certify that specific evidence sought in the course of litigation is truly a secret and cannot be revealed without danger to overriding essential government interests. Now, this is very important because what they're saying is that the majority used a bulldozer when they should have used a little trowel. And that by burying this entire case and not allowing it to go forward, instead of selectively entertaining claims that, okay, Jeppesen is known, but how they were paid is a secret, okay?
Yeah.
That, you know, might be valid. But to claim, as we have said here, that things we already know have to be treated as secret and therefore deny any due process to these individuals, it's unconstitutional, and that seems very clear to me.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, it's why I quoted at length from the dissent. I mean, you know, because these were the, you know, as I said earlier, these were the judges who granted the plaintiff's claim to proceed last May that was so unconstitutionally overturned on bank. And, I mean, it's just depressing because you read that and that should be the majority opinion. You know, this should be the judges saying to the government, okay, now let's lay down some instructions about how we're going to proceed and what you are entitled to do and not do. And, you know, I mean, contrast with this country is that, you know, in a civil claim for damages that was brought by six former Guantanamo prisoners in the UK, they've got the judges on their side and the government is now having to go through 500,000 documents, and you know there is a process of them having to release some of these, and that kind of thing that these judges are talking about here, of having to evaluate what can be and can't be released and on what basis it may or may not happen, is happening here in the UK. I mean, it's prompted the government to you know, to a kind of panic. I mean, it's costing them a lot of money to do this. But they want to, you know, they would like to put a lid on it, of course. You know, we're not for openness here either. They're trying at the moment to reach a financial settlement with these former prisoners in the hope that they can bind them to silence as a result. And then this torture inquiry that was announced by the new government here will be allowed to proceed in a toothless and closed manner, and there'll be a slap on the wrist for the security services, and it will be business as usual. But, you know, that's a compromise story here in the UK, but it's, you know, it's astonishingly open compared to, you know, what's just happened a couple of weeks ago in the Ninth Circuit.
You mean here in the land of the free and home of the brave?
Yes.
Well, Andy, is there anything else you'd like to add about this Ninth Circuit Court decision? I imagine it will be appealed, but it's hard to believe that the current composition of the Supreme Court would even hear the case.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, that's what I have tended to think as well. And, you know, the situation, you know, since Justice Stevens retired is that, you know, looking at the way decisions have been made in the past, we've got Kagan who has to recuse herself from anything that involves these issues because she, you know, was involved in arguing on the government's behalf in so mm-hmm. many cases as Solicitor General. And the way that most people seem to look at it is that then splits the court 4-4, and that's not enough to win on any of these issues. But I have seen legal commentators recently suggesting that it may not be quite as clear-cut as that.
Okay.
So, you know, I wouldn't express great optimism just simply because I think the role I attribute to Justice Stevens, actually, in a kind of old-school respect for the law that isn't tinged with politics. You know, that he was his rulings that he was responsible for directing in a lot of ways in the Supreme Court weren't. I mean, you know, maybe you can't say that judicial rulings are never swayed by politics, but he attempted to just observe the law. The same as the judges in this country, when they've said enough to the government, have been doing that. They've just been looking at the law and saying, you know, actually, my topic of expertise is the law, and according to what I'm dealing with, you're not allowed to do this. So I don't care whether you like me telling you that was wrong or not. And, you know, the problem that I think that we have is judges who are clearly politically aligned.
Yeah. So, Andy, I just wanted to touch on a few recent posts at andyworthington.co.uk. First, you noted the 24th birthday of Canadian detainee Omar Khadr, and that was on the 10th of September. He's now 24, and as you point out, he's spent a third of his life in American custody. And last I heard, his trial was on suspension because one of the attorneys was ill. What's the current state there, and when is it scheduled to resume?
Well, you know, it's scheduled to resume on October the 18th. His lawyer was taken ill, so it was delayed. But there seems to be no way to stop this. I mean, you know, the Canadians don't want him back. So they absolutely have to share the blame for this whole disaster with the Obama administration. But the Obama administration's behavior with the trial of Omar Khadr has, you know, it's been ridiculous, really. I mean, recently, you know, officials were telling, I think it was the Washington Post, it may have been the New York Times, but, you know, they were complaining about how much bad press they were getting, that they had hoped that Omar Khadr's trial wouldn't really be quite so prominent, that they'd hoped to kind of hide it behind something that would show the military commissions in a more favorable light. Well, if you have your doubts about why you should be prosecuting a former child prisoner who you were supposed to rehabilitate according to treaties that you signed, why on earth are you doing it? You know, it's kind of worse than what the Bush administration did. You know, the Bush administration officials stood up and said, I don't care if you call these children. They're not children. We don't care. We're going to prosecute them in a trumped-up trial that isn't fair. But we think it's fair because we're tough. What you're getting from the Obama administration, I don't know. I mean, I just wrote a comment about it recently. It said that the way they're behaving is they'll stitch you up in a phony war crimes trial and then perhaps apologize afterwards while locking you up and throwing away the key. You know?
Yeah.
I simply don't understand it, you know? Everybody's sitting around behind the scenes going, yeah, it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? Don't do it. You know, there is no excuse for putting a former child prisoner on trial, let alone in a trial which has clearly been demonstrated by legal experts, involves invented war crimes charges. They're not real.
Correct. Yeah. And that that's at the basis of all this. And we have a situation here where it really revolves around, unfortunately, a very simple proposition. And that is the Democrats are just scared shitless to show any weakness, anything that can be perceived or even distorted into weakness on these issues.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they're... It's tragic that they don't have the really the confidence, the balls, to say, look, we're going to stand on this on principle and let them flail away at us because they don't have principle. They simply have noise.
Yeah,
the problem is that
right and some things are wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, surely that would stand them in best stead. But apparently not, you know. I mean, they blow with the wind while their opponents come up with, you know, one monstrous lie after another that they fell successfully. It's a pretty depressing scenario, I think, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it certainly is. Also, at your website, you have a two-part series of posts regarding an interesting debate that recently occurred, And it involves David Fracht, who has been a lawyer for those held at Guantanamo. Stephen Jones, who defended Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber. Head of National Intelligence, Michael Hayden. And he, of course, was at the NSA before that. And Mark Tyson, who is a quote-unquote journalist in this country. I haven't had a chance to read it, so give us a thumbnail on this debate that was held.
Well, it was just essentially a debate, you know, between these two very different parties about the respect for the rule of law, actually. I mean, there were obviously loads of, plaintive distractions regarding the use of torture and the terrorist threat and a changed world. Both Dave Fracht and the other speaker, Stephen Jones, they stuck very, very calmly and solidly to their argument about the reasons for the necessity to respect the rule of law and exposing the ways in which all the aberrations were so dangerous to pretty much everything you think of, really, you know, counterproductive in terms of what they were supposed to achieve, damaging to the foundations of the United States and how it perceived itself and how it needs to function. What was interesting about the debate was that, you know, the organization is called Intelligence Squared US, and they have these regularly on kind of hot topics. And so they take a vote beforehand, and then they take a vote afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
What I was very glad to see was that they managed to sway about 20% of the audience to come around to their point of view, and they won it. Now, if only that could be replicated on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm.
Because clearly, I think it shows that you put those four men down with an audience of people. I mean, this was in New York. But they changed people's minds. There were people who were undecided in significant numbers, and they said, right, I'm going with these guys. I'm not going with the former head of the CIA and this guy Tyson, despite how many books he sold. But that, to me, is the depressing thing afterwards, is that you look at the sway and influence of somebody like Mark Tyson.
Yeah.
It would be practical, I think, not to buy the Washington Post while they continue to employ this poison.
Well, it's
too late for his book sales. I mean, you know, God knows how many books he sold.
Well, there are a lot of other reasons to be wary of the Washington Post. It's way too much like it's the Washington Times, the Mooney paper, that is known to pander to the right wing. But the Post has really declined in the last 10 years or so. And finally, Andy, you do an update on the current population at Guantanamo. And with the two who were sent to Germany, I take it that the current count on the Jumbotron is 172?
No, it's 174, actually.
Okay, that includes those two?
No, that's excluding those two.
Okay.
174 guys still in Guantanamo.
And you mentioned earlier that about a quarter of those are Yemenis. The Uyghurs remain there for the most part?
There are five of them, actually. I mean, half of the remaining prisoners are Yemenis.
Oh, half, okay.
The Uyghurs, there are five Uyghurs left because they didn't want to go to the countries that were found for them. They were afraid that Palau, for example, which, you know, I don't know whether everybody knows where Palau is, but it's in the Pacific. It's a small island nation with strong ties to the United States that doesn't recognize the People's Republic of China. But they were afraid that they weren't going to be safe there. Now, you know, I don't know whether they were justified in fearing that. But as these were men who were wrongly seized and abused for so many years, were comprehensively cleared for release by this U.S. judge 2 years ago, who said, actually, you know, constitutionally, you have no right to keep holding these guys. And as you can't find anywhere else to send them, they really should come and live in the United States. But they've turned down offers that have been made, and as a result, their case has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, who sent it back down to the D.C. Circuit Court, of all places, again, where the judges are ferociously opposed to any prisoner in Guantanamo, however innocent, having any rights whatsoever. So they're stuck. They're waiting for somebody else to offer them a new home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have no idea when that will be.
Yeah.
But they've exhausted, really, the legal opportunities. There are a few more challenges coming up, because this is one of the stories that's been happening that involves the D.C. Circuit Court, is that it's an unresolved issue, really. You know, I mean, my understanding is that if the Supreme Court grants habeas corpus rights to prisoners in Guantanamo, it intends there to be some teeth to that remedy, that if a district court judge turns to the government and says, you know, you have failed to demonstrate, even with this incredibly low threshold of evidence, that this man is a danger or has ever been a danger or a threat to the United States, you must let him go. And then there's nowhere to send him. The D.C. Circuit Court has been very, very demonstrative about saying, we absolutely don't care about that. We have no court has any right to order the release of a prisoner anywhere. It is completely up to the executive whether they choose to do that or not. And it's left cleared prisoners who can't be returned with... It's making the decisions worthless.
Yeah.
You know? If they're not caught by that, they're caught by the fact that a judge says, hey, you just failed to prove anything, and the government appeals,
mm-hmm.
which they keep doing in a rather shockingly large number of cases. Never actually just giving up and saying, you know, let this man go. Let's find some way around this.
Well, Andy, as you're describing that, it just reminds me, I just completed a book and will be interviewing the author in an upcoming podcast. He's traveling right now, so I can't offer a specific date. But Phil Butler is an American who was the seventh longest held captive in North Vietnam during the war there. He was held just short of 8 years. And just as a reference point, he was there a good year and a half longer than Senator John McCain. And his book is so touching because he spent that whole time not knowing how long he would be there.
Right.
And he was held indefinitely. He was, I suppose, charged because the North Vietnamese claimed that he was not a prisoner of war. He was simply a criminal.
Yeah.
But there were no proceedings. He never had a hearing. He was simply held in these various facilities, mostly at the Hanoi Hilton, but at several other locations around North Vietnam. And they were, I think, over the course of the nearly 8 years, he received only 16 letters from home, most of those within weeks before he was released.
Right.
So he spent that time just completely out of touch. The only information he was able to get was from newly captured American flyers, and some of them were non-military CIA people. But his experience in that kind of open-ended, undefined detention is very similar to what we are imposing on these 174 individuals now. And it can't be justified in any manner, yet we are able to defy the Geneva Conventions and to evade any effort to hold the United States responsible. And it's really the most shameful aspect of American policy in my lifetime.
Well, absolutely. I agree with you, Peter. And, you know, I'm extremely glad that you're still covering this. I'm just disappointed that, you know, we keep having to talk about it. You know, it's 9 years since the attacks that prompted this. You know, we may well talk again before the ninth anniversary of the prison opening in January 2011. But it's not that far off. And
yeah.
How much longer will this go on? I mean, everything that you told me about that story, the parallels were there.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was eventually freed.
Yeah.
There appears to be no end in sight for most of these men.
That's right.
Who are held at Guantanamo.
Yeah. Well, Andy, we will talk again. I thank you for your detailed and consistent coverage of these issues, and I direct people to your website. And I know you could use some financial help because you do this mostly as a freelancer. So if you're in a position, go to andyworthington.co.uk. read his work, and assist him if you can. Andy, cheers. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And now, comedian, satirist Will Durst joins us. It appears he needs some anger management courses.
Hey guys, Will Durst here, hooking into the hot new political zeitgeist. I'm mad. Mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take it anymore. Take what? I have no idea. I'm just mad. Angry. Riled up. Cranky. Irate. Livid. Bellicose. Splenetic. Which has something to do with the spleen. Not sure what. Might involve leakage. Whatever it is, can't be good, and I got it. I'm mad at everyone and everything, but I'm especially mad at career politicians and career pediatricians. From now on, whenever one of my kids gets sick, I'm trusting them to some incensed old coot right off the street carrying a misspelled sign. I'm mad about paying taxes because I don't like paying taxes. And flossing. I hate that too. Who needs teeth? Members of the lamestream media elite, that's who, so they can lie through them. I'm mad about having to work two jobs just to get by, and I'm mad that rich people don't get more tax cuts. I'm mad about our Muslim president being born in Kenya. And don't bother me with your so-called facts. I know what I know, and it makes me so mad I could spit. And I do, often. I'm mad at my own party, and I don't care if what I do hurts them because they're not as mad as I am. I'm so mad I'll bite off both of my own hands, one finger at a time, if that's what it takes. No, I'm mad at the government and all their silly nitpicking rules. Let the corporations regulate themselves. They know what they're doing. I'm mad at the French. I'm mad at French's mustard. And I'm mad at people who put ketchup on hot dogs. I'm even mad at people who are mad at people who put ketchup on hot dogs. But the people who make me maddest of all are those people who aren't mad. Oh, they make me so mad. But you watch, they will be soon enough, because my madness won't stop until they're just as mad as me.
For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
I ain't happy.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I'd like to hear your comments. Just send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.